Time now for another edition of the Better Health Radio Show. And every Sunday, around this time, we've got Dr. Renee Boyce as she presents to you the Better Health Radio Show. She usually has some guests or guests with her. This evening, I think she has one guest. So let's say good evening to Dr. Boyce. Good evening, Dr. Renee Boyce. Yes, you might want to. Yes, you might want to turn your mic on there, Madam Doc.
Yes. Hi. Good evening, Grayson. You're really relishing that fact.
No, not at all. It's just that, you know, all of us forget once in a while. Some of us forget every while, but that's all right.
I'm going to leave that alone. Good evening to you. Good evening to everybody. Welcome again to the Better Health Radio Show, helping you to live your best life. As usual, we have a very informative and enlightening show planned for you this evening. And the number to reach us in studio, and I will keep saying us, 434-1790. And to send a WhatsApp so Gredston can read it, you can reach him over there in the studio at 266-4862. So those digits once again. Oh dear. What are the numbers again, Gredston?
434-1790 and 266-4862.
4862. You see, I can claim age now. I can claim age. Six and counting. Anyway,
I claimed age a long time ago.
Yeah, the numbers just went out of my head. But that's probably because I am excited about today's show. But let me send a shout out. The first one I'm going to send is to Miss Beverly Allen. She is a regular listener to the show. Her sister, Miranda Squires, informed me that as much as she can, Beverly doesn't miss a show. So good evening to you, Beverly. I ran into somebody else. Don't remember their name, but they told me that they listened to the show. So that person that I ran into, that I don't remember your name, but you do remember that you told me that you listened to the show. Shout out to you as well. And I'll have some special greetings towards the end, but let me introduce you to my guest this evening. This evening, we are going to be discussing bleeders in Barbados. And to speak to us this evening is Dr. Cheryl Alexis. Dr. Alexis is a consultant pediatric heme oncologist at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital. And that's a nice rounded title for, she is a doctor who specializes in dealing with blood diseases and cancers with a little specialty in children. That's correct. Good evening, Dr. Alexis, and welcome.
Good evening, everyone. Good evening, Renee. Thanks for inviting me today. And I'm excited about the show, as you would continue to hear about what is happening about with bleeders in Barbados.
And for as long as Dr. Alexis has lived here in Barbados, you can tell that she is from Trinidad and Tobago. That Trini accent is going nowhere. For all the years I've known her. So we have a lot to cover, a lot of ground that we want to cover. So as usual on the show, we start with the basics. For those persons who don't know, the first question we are going to answer is, what is hemophilia?
Okay, so hemophilia is a bleeding condition in which we are missing one of the clotting factors. So to go back a little bit, for us to, whenever we bleed, we have to clot. So in order to form the clot, we have what we call clotting factors, and they are all numbered 1 to 13. So that, along with platelets, which are in the blood, help to form the clot. And in to every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. So those people, so when you form the clot, we don't want you to clot off your whole system. So there are what we call natural anticoagulants to break down the clot. And it is a very special and balanced system that goes on. But we are dealing with deficiencies in the clotting factors. So there's what we call the coagulation cascade, which eventually forms your clot. And hemophilia, you are missing one of these clotting factors. Now, the most common clotting factor is factor 8. And that is lower down in the cascade. So the cascade has two parts. One we call the intrinsic pathway and one we call the extrinsic pathway. And factor eight is activated, and that is activates factor 10, which is in a common pathway to go and form the clot. And if you are deficient in that, well, because of that, that's like building a bridge and one of the pieces is missing. It will still form the bridge, but it would be a little lopsided, if you want to say that. So you can form a clot. You're not going to bleed out to death, but you can form the clot, but the clot would be very fragile. And then the other hemophilia that is common, but not as common as the factor 8 deficiency, or what we call hemophilia A, there's factor 9 deficiency or hemophilia B, which is another one of the clotting factors that is deficient in hemophilia.
So is this a very common disease here in our population? Is it a common disease worldwide?
It is not a common disease worldwide or here, but it is an inherited disorder in the majority of cases, and it is inherited through the X chromosome. So that is, it affects men or boys, the male population. There are a few, maybe female population, but that's a bit more complicated, but in the majority, the males are affected. And they can get bleeding of the mucosal surfaces, like your mouth, your gut, under the skin and the nose especially, and bleeding into the joints. And that's where the problem comes in. In Barbados, we have a higher than even in the rest of the Caribbean, although our numbers are small, but per population, we have quite a higher prevalence, almost like three times some of the prevalences that are quoted in the other Caribbean islands.
Okay, so even although, like you just said, there is still only a small group of hemophiliacs. When you compare our numbers to the other numbers of hemophiliacs in the other Caribbean countries, we seem to have more of them in our country than they do in their countries.
Yeah, it is talking not numbers, but prevalence, meaning, mm-hmm. you know, per population, how many patients there are.
Okay.
And this, I think, is to do what we call a founder gene effect. Because in the factor 8 or hemophilia A population, a lot of it, about two-thirds, affects the Barbadian white population, which, as you know from history, what we call the red legs or Ekibekis, they came in the 1600s. From Irish stock. And we believe that is where the gene originated and how it came down to Barbados.
Okay, so we got hemophilia from Ireland. We have Irish.
Irish. Some of it, not all, but a lot of the patients are of that stock.
So what are some of the complications that can arise from this disorder, hemophilia? And we had mentioned earlier the way that it's inherited, that it seems to be, not seems to be, it is more common in boys. So what are some of the complications that can arise as a result of the disease itself? We're going to go on to talk about complications of treatment in a little bit.
Okay, so we classify hemophilia dependent on the amount of factor 8, or we can find the percentage of factor 8 that the patient has. So if you have less than 1% of factor 8, you are called severe. If you have 1 to 5% of factor 8, you are moderate. And more than 5%, you are mild. Okay, so what we have known from research is that for you to live a normal life, you can have maybe about 5 to 10%. But these mild hemophiliacs, if there's any trauma or anything like that, that's when they bleed, as opposed to the severe hemophiliacs, which they don't need any trauma to bleed because they don't have enough of that. The major complications that we see is bleeding into the joints. And as you would imagine, that is very painful. And so they have pain, they cannot walk on the limb, and it's blood in the joint. Now, blood is an irritant. So if we do not treat that in a timely manner, these patients can go on to have what we call chronic hemarthrosis, where there is damage to the joint, and therefore the joint is of no use and swollen, and some of them are unable to walk with that. So that's the major bleeding. The other thing is that when they go for things like dental surgery or any surgeries, if we do not treat them before, they can bleed. And commonly patients bleed in the mouth. A lot of the times the boys are diagnosed, if we don't have a family history, they start bleeding when teeth start coming up, erupting, usually around 6 to 9 months of age. You would notice that. You can also have bleeding under the skin, what we call black and blues. So that can be a symptom as well. And they can also bleed into the muscle, and you would get swelling of the area. Sometimes, dependent on which muscle it is, it can actually trap nerves and blood vessels and cause problems with that.
Yeah, so hemophilia really and truly is something that we need to raise awareness about. And a little later on in the program, we're going to talk about the local organization and some plans that we have for trying to streamline the treatment and streamline the way that the persons with hemophilia access care. But let's learn a little bit more about hemophilia. We had a show, I believe it might have been last year, because this year has simply flown by, despite all the trouble. I believe it was last year where we had interviewed Sean. I think he is obviously a hemophiliac, and he spoke about his knee being a target joint. So in the language of hemophilia, what does that mean?
So a target joint is, as you say, a target. That's the joint that gives the most problems. And most hemophiliacs have some target joint. It might be one, it might be two, it might be three. That is like the weak spot. We don't know why. One, certainly some are more like targeted than others, but you know, that can occur as well. So we identify a target joint by the joint that gives the most problem and have recurrent bleeding.
So we know that there is treatment for hemophilia. One of the things that we are happy for is many of the advances that occur in medicine. And hemophilia treatment is one of those things. How is hemophilia managed? What are some of the different ways in which the disorder is managed?
Okay, so the major treatment would be factor replacement, okay? So the hemophilia, the factors are made in the blood, and they are contained in the plasma of the blood. And before we used to get what we call plasma-derived products, where we can give the plasma to the patient. Well, sorry, you can use plasma alone. So before we got even plasma-derived products, we used to just use plasma and another portion of plasma called cryoprecipitate, which we would use to treat. Then they found a way of extracting that, so you would get a more concentrated form of the factor. And we got that with the plasma-derived products. these had to, so like to get one dose of hemophilia, you probably will need about 20 donors. And before the testing and so with HIV, that's why when HIV became a thing, the hemophiliacs were targeted, or the ones that came up that showed signs of HIV, because they got it from infected donors. This is before we knew about it. Now we have what we call the recombinant factors, where it is actually made in the lab. So that is one of the things that is done. So we call it recombinant, and you can get that, and you get a dose, and they have different concentrations dependent on what you need. So it's a concentrated form, and most of the time the doses make up like 10 to 15 mils, which is like two to three teaspoons that you have to inject intravenously. A few years ago, we got what we call a monoclonal antibody, which is an antibody which is to the factor, and it sort of bridges, it's not factor 8, but it bridges the factor 9 and factor 10, where, and it fits into that factor. That is very expensive, and you know, we don't have it in Barbados, but that's one of the newer things. And then the other thing is that we are learning about is gene therapy, and there are studies going on with that. So that is to treat the factor deficiency, but then we have to treat also the problem with the knee. So we have a mnemonic that we use to say, to treat the, when they get a bleed in the knee, we call it RICE. So it's rest, ice it, compression, and elevate. So we usually tell when they get an acute bleed, that's what they need to do. And so in looking after the joint, the physiotherapists play an important role in looking after the health of these hemophiliacs. And the thing is, with the physiotherapists, they have to be specially trained. So we do have two trained specialists here in Barbados now who can look after the patients with hemophilia and their joint problems.
I would take this opportunity to go over to the Department of Rehabilitation Medicine, commonly known as the Physiotherapy Department at the hospital, and say hello to all the therapists down there, and especially to those who are specially trained in hemophilia. It really is very heartwarming when we can have, as a nation, persons who are specialized in these smaller areas so that we can get the best treatment that we need for those persons who unfortunately have various illnesses within our population. So I'm very proud to know some of those persons, especially. It's not about me at all, but they're wonderful men and women in that department. Very friendly, very, very knowledgeable. Many of them are actually doctors of physiotherapy, highly qualified men and women. So if you're just joining us, we are discussing bleeders in Barbados or hemophilia here in Barbados with Dr. Cheryl Alexis, a consultant hemo-oncologist at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital. And we've discussed so far what hemophilia is. It's a bleeding disorder. We're missing one of the factors that stops you from bleeding, and therefore it takes you a lot longer to stop bleeding, depending on the severity of hemophilia that you might have. And we were just discussing treatments. We spoke about where treatments have come from, or from where treatments have come, where initially it took 20 donors to get one dose of medication because you had to try to collect enough plasma to make a dose, all the way up to where we're thinking about gene therapy. We don't have it here in Barbados yet, but eventually, in a couple decades, you never know, maybe a decade, we'll get it done here in Barbados too. So what sorts of precautions, Dr. Alexis, because we're going to get to the registry just now. That's the exciting thing that we are going to be discussing this evening. What sorts of precautions would you give to parents of children who have hemophilia?
So we try not to limit the children too much, because as they are boys, they active, and you know, what can you do? You can't put them in a, sorry about that. You can't put them in a, oh, sorry, my phone is ringing.
Well, you can't, well, Dr. Alexis was saying that you just can't confine them. These are little boys. They're going to do whatever they feel like doing.
You can't bubble wrap them.
Yes.
So what we advise is that they can still do sports, but obviously with protection and protective gear. And so we recommend some of the sports which don't put a lot of pressure on your knees, like swimming and things like that. But there is a famous Canadian, skier, ice hockey player, and he has hemophilia. And I mean, what other sport that you would have that that is worse? And you know, for contact sports and so.
Wow.
And he goes out and speaks about, you know, playing with hemophilia, you know, so, but I know sometimes when we tell parents, you know, that they can do, they are very skeptical, you know, about it. But, you know, you try for them to continue, because this is something that they're going to have for life. So, you know, you need to work with them and see how best we can facilitate, you know, them doing what they wish to do with limitations, basically.
Yeah, I think I remember somebody saying that the two groups you're most concerned about would be the very young ones, because they have no clue as to what is going on with them. And then the other group would be the teenagers, because they don't want to be different from the other boys. And so they try to prove themselves, you know, I can do just as well as you can. And I do remember when I was doing pediatrics, we had a set of cousins. They were like tandem. You would have one week, and then 2 weeks after, the other one would turn up. Just
yeah, skateboarding, right?
Of all the things to do. But they're grown men now, and they're doing well. So yeah. About 3 years ago, I think, three, maybe could even be five, because the time is just going by. The persons who have hemophilia, the parents and those older persons with hemophilia, as well as those younger ones who have hemophilia, decided that it would be a good idea to get together to form an organization. And out of that, the Barbados Hemophilia Association was formed. And the mandate of that organization is SHARE. And the SHARE stands for Support Hemophilia Awareness Research and Education. And this is one of the purposes of the show this evening, trying to raise awareness about hemophilia, because to my surprise, we had done a sort of, I don't want to say open house, but we did a session at one of the supermarkets in St. Michael. And one lady asked if hemophilia was part of diabetes. Mm-hmm. And it shows the lack of knowledge in the population and the need for an association such as the Hemophilia Association. We have a call, so we're going to take that call, and then we'll get back to discussing the registry that's going to be happening.
Okay.
Good evening. Welcome to the Better Health Radio Show.
Good evening to you, Dr. Boyce, Dr. Alexis, and Mr. Seeley. Dr. Alexis, I have a question for you. Good evening, ma'am. I have a question for you, Dr. Like, yeah, good evening.
Seems to be a
delay. Anyway, the question I have for you is, once a NR conk, blood conk, that is, has anything to do with the subject being discussed? Is there any correlation between the two?
Sorry, what count was that?
INR.
INR.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Yeah, well, sort of, and not really. So we to A test that we do for clotting or coagulation is called the prothrombin time and the partial thromboplastin time. So the prothrombin time tests what we call the extrinsic pathway, and the partial thromboplastin time checks the intrinsic pathway. Now, the extrinsic pathway is really to do with factor 7, and the intrinsic pathway is factor 8 and factor 9. So if those are deficient, those times are prolonged. Now, what the INR is an international ratio that rarely was made for people who are on warfarin, which a lot of people call rat poison. But what it does, it those people who have a tendency to clot, it makes the blood thinner. So when people are being treated with warfarin, the reagent that is used differs across the world. So if you do a PTT here, it will differ from a PTT if the patient goes overseas. But what this international normalized ratio or INR does is that brings all to one thing. So what happens is that they take into consideration the sensitivity of the reagent that is done. And the INR would be to measure how thick or thin your blood is. The higher the number, the thinner the blood is. And that measures, that will tell you if your warfarin is therapeutic or if you need to take more or you need to take less.
Yes,
so although it doesn't have to do with hemophilia, it is part of the clotting
system. But I just want to say that the warfarin, like you just and quite rightly so said, that a good INR count would be 2.5. And up to 3, but beyond 3, you need to reduce your warfarin, because if your blood get too thin, you can have internal bleeding. And below 2,
yeah,
it can get thick, and that can cause clotting. So you have to have the correct dosage of the warfarin. Am I correct, Doc?
Yes, you are, in a sense. The INR would be the number, or the range will right. depend on what you are being treated for. Yeah. Okay, so some people, especially people who had their heart valves
yeah.
and so they will have to have a higher number, like 3 to 4.5. In that, but your doctor will tell you what range you need to be at for your condition. So the range does vary a little bit with their condition.
And we are quite... Mm-hmm. Has anything to do with age, though?
No, not really. There are some genetic things sometimes that can affect the warfarin level, and also dietary factors, because warfarin is what we call a vitamin K antagonist, meaning that it antagonizes vitamin K, which makes a lot of the factors. All right. So hence, that is why it thins the blood. So anything that is high in vitamin K
right.
can affect your warfarin level. So it's yeah, not to mean that you can't eat anything with vitamin K. What we try to do is keep the level, because warfarin is a very kind of labile drug. So what we try to do is keep the vitamin K at a certain level in the body, so that you don't have your ups and downs with your warfarin therapy.
Right. And also not only vitamin K that you would get in things like celery and broccoli and those green leafy vegetables, but what can also offset your warfarin, the way your warfarin work, is a lot of fruits with high acid levels, like grapefruit and orange and that kind of, any fruits with high acid level. Anyway, well, Doc, thanks for taking my call. I was listening to you on the radio.
Well, thank you for calling, sir.
Thank you. Yeah, too.
Thank you so much for calling. And what his question has highlighted is that every illness is unique to the patient. So you might have the same diagnosis as somebody, but your management is unique to you. So it's always important. We always reiterate on the show why you must speak to your physician, know your numbers, know your HbA1c, what your blood pressure should be, what your INR should be for the management of your condition.